WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I spoke with Mailer in 1991 after the publication of his book, Harlot's Ghost.
I think you were one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality, and to have that personality be, in a way, a part of your art. Do you think of yourself, or at least your public self, as being one of your greatest characters?
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. If I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, oh, you know, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. Most, after all, the sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. And so... The mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll look up they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
You used to always measure yourself against other writers in advertisements for myself. You wrote, "It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill." Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, novelists may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, oh, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years, I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. It'll be a most special and peculiar activity, almost.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual, and you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then wife's father had been a professional fighter, and whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, "Come on, let's put on the gloves." He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly in the hard way, and then after that I got interested in it. And did more and more boxing, and then I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years, and I've boxed with him a great deal. At one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I could answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through, I grew up in Brooklyn, and you know, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't. I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle-class neighborhood. But I do think that what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years. And the shock of that. And then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity. And that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. You know, young people at Harvard, Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. You know, we were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life. And everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice. And even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob. And so that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier. And I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch, maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through my ego was battered. And I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing. But I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship. Just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. You know, I feel, well, you know, they keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing. They're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
We're listening back to a 1991 interview with Norman Mailer. He died Saturday at the age of 84. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview with Norman Mailer that we recorded in 1991.
You know, you might be one of the few major writers of your generation who is Jewish and for whom Jewishness hasn't been a major theme in your fiction. Do you think that's true, that you're one of the few?
Yes, and I think it hasn't been a major theme, but I think on the other hand, it's informed every sentence I've written. You know, being Jewish is a state of mind. It's a way of receiving life and perceiving it and evaluating it, and it affects every one of one's judgments. It affects one's style. In fact, it was Norman Podaritz, once remarked many years ago that there were two kinds of Jews in history, he felt, if one were to speak very generally. One was the essentially Orthodox Jew who returned to tradition and was deeply enmeshed in it and thought of himself or herself as a Jew and primarily a Jew and always a Jew. And then there was the Jew who became the mirror of the time and aped the manners of all those people who were not Jewish, didn't copy them literally, but became so sensitive to the manners of those who were not Jewish that he might end up knowing more about it than they did. One example of this is, although he was not Jewish, his parents were Jewish. Disraeli is a wonderful example of that. He didn't look British, but he was more British. He was more English than the English. So in that sense, I think I would belong to that second category. I've always been interested in writing about things that are not Jewish precisely because I half understand them and I want to know more about them. But I think that, I've never said to myself, well, I'm really not Jewish. I know damn well how Jewish I am.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. No, I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well. Just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just, I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth and so forth. Whatever. It's hard for me to talk about a good review. After all, a man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I wonder if you think that the best aspects of the women's movement, the most open and least doctrinaire, have affected your view of women or your view of yourself as a man.
Oh, no question. It's been going on now for 20 years, and it's had a huge effect, some for the good and some for the bad. I think what women are maybe beginning to face now is as they gain equality with men, they're also going to be taking on all of men's problems. And a great many of men's problems are just dreary. And on top of that, since men have been, in effect, wrecking the world, let's speak ecologically, look what man has done to the natural world. The question is, once women become equal to men, are they going to then begin to direct the world into better places? There's very little evidence of that so far.
I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss. Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel like, do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
Norman Mailer recorded 16 years ago. He died of renal failure Saturday. He was 84. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.